Hello. Tonight I'll be looking at the songs of experience, which complement the songs of innocence. Blake once said, without contraries, there is no progression, and it's clear that the two sequences were part of a single scheme, like a painting with light and shade. When he published both collections together, he entitled the volume Songs of Innocence and Experience, Two Contrary States of the Human Soul. As with the Songs of Innocence, the Songs of Experience also begins with a poem entitled Introduction, and the contrast with innocence is immediate. Gone is the piper, here Blake's voice is the bard, authoritative, foreboding, severe. Hear the voice of the bard, who present, past, and future sees, whose ears have heard the holy word that walked among the ancient trees, calling the lapsed soul and weeping in the evening dew that might control the starry pole and fallen, fallen light renew. O earth, return. Night is worn and the morn rises from the slumbrous mass. Turn away no more. Why wilt thou turn away? The starry floor, the watery shore, is given thee till the break of day. This is Blake conjuring the spirit of the ancient bard and invoking the slumbrous masses. The bard addresses the fallen and sinful earth, pleading with it to return to grace, the starry shore. Blake was writing at a time of great political turbulence. The War of Independence in America and the Revolution in France had created high hopes that tyranny was about to be overthrown, at least if you were a Republican like Blake. But it also created fear and uncertainty. That's echoed in this introductory poem, which has a mood of darkness and of premonition. The title, Songs of Experience, warns us to expect more bracing and challenging material than in Songs of Innocence. But Blake uses the same lyrical format. Each poem is short lines and simple rhythms and rhymes, like a plain old rustic ballad. So here he creates a tension between form and substance. The starry floor, the watery shore, is given thee till the break of day. Blake famously met his beloved wife, Catherine Boucher, when he went to stay with relatives of his father's in Battersea. He was recovering from a difficult love affair with a girl who allowed him to keep company with her, but refused to marry him. When he complained about her seeing other men, she turned to him and said, "Are you a fool?" And later in life, Blake would say, "That cured me of jealousy." Full of heartache, he recounted stories of the painful love to Catherine, walking in the fields around Battersea. And when she expressed her sympathy, he asked her, "Do you pity me?" "Yes, indeed I do." "Then I love you," he said. Later in the collection, Blake includes My Pretty Rose Tree, a poem about jealousy, and I think he sees it as a measure of pain in life's experience. "A flower was offered to me, such a flower as May never bore, but I said I've a pretty rose tree, and I passed the sweet flower o'er. Then I went to my pretty rose tree, to tend her by day and by night, but my rose turned away with jealousy, and her thorns were my only delight." It's as if a man is saying to his wife, "I had the chance of having an affair, but I didn't take it." And rather than being relieved or grateful, the wife is angry with him. Blake understands the complexities of possessive love, even though his own marriage to Catherine was long-lasting and apparently harmonious. Catherine was illiterate when she met Blake, but with his help she learned to read, and she became an accomplished engraver in her own right. It can't have been easy living with a man who saw angels in trees and spent his entire life writing poems that hardly anyone bought. One of her few recorded comments is, "I have very little of Mr. Blake's company. He is always in paradise." I should think Blake would have approved of that remark. There are strong echoes of a paradise in a poisoned tree, which draws an imagery from the Garden of Eden, but which Blake uses as a kind of subterfuge to tell a darker story. "I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not, my wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears, and I sunned it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles, and it grew both day and night, till it bore an apple bright, and my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when the night had veiled the pole, in the morning glad I see, my foe outstretched beneath the tree." This is a great poem about friendship, or what one thought of as friendship, but which turned out to be something else. Blake uses the figure of the poison tree as a vehicle for describing the way in which love between friends can be transferred into hatred and anger. There's an intense psychology here, how people project their fears and self-loathing onto one another. It is a version of the fall of Eden because the foes outstretched beneath the tree. Although I don't think it's about taking the apple of the tree of knowledge, but rather going against the friend, and the ending is very sinister. As if two people were friends and then one of the friends does something that makes him vulnerable, and the other seizes the opportunity of striking him while he's down and pounces on him, and that's the end of the friendship. To me, the most perfect poem in the collection and one of the greatest English lyrics is The Sick Rose, which opens with the extraordinary and arresting image of a rose affected by disease. O rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. The bed of crimson joy stands for Blake's ideal of happiness, an England before the monarchy's imposed order and repression. The bed of crimson joy may also be the Garden of Eden, as in Milton's poem Paradise Lost, which itself stands for the English Commonwealth. The invisible worm has all kinds of resonances with Satan and the evil angels in the second book of Paradise Lost, and the war in heaven that led to the fall of man. For Milton, the fall represents the collapse of the English Commonwealth and the restoration of the monarchy. And for Blake, the howling storm is the storm of existence, Blake's experience in the turmoil in England, the struggle for freedom, and the reaction against the revolutionary wars in America. But as you'd expect with Blake, the tone is not ecclesiastical, but almost pantheistic. Blake was a Christian, but he was strongly opposed to authority and hierarchies. His Christianity was strictly egalitarian. He was once asked if he believed in the divinity of Christ, and he said, "He is the only God," and quickly added, "But so am I, and so are you." Although it is the simplicity of a nursery rhyme, the poem has enormous political sophistication and technical subtlety. Look at the strange phrase, "dark secret love," where I think Blake is referring to powerful sexual love. He puts an extra beat into the line, an extra syllable, giving a strong and deliberate emphasis to the word dark. Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? It's a poem or song that I've known all my life, and I think it is a truly great work. But what does it mean? David Erdman, a great authority on Blake, points out that in the 1790s the tiger was frequently used as an emblem of the revolutionary Paris mob. So this is a poem about revolution, about the god of wrath and the ungovernable passions of the mob. But the god of wrath is also the god of mercy, the god who created the lamb. So the poem is asking a question. How did this natural and virtuous force, the spirit of popular dissent, create a tigerish world of massacre and bloodshed? In the third verse, Blake seems to presage the ideas dealt with by Mary Shelley in Frankenstein. And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? Shelley's Frankenstein monster is also a symbol of the mob, which is a new force in politics, the appetite of the masses. When the stars threw down their spears and showered heaven with their tears. Of course, there's a prophetic, almost wishful element to this, as if Blake were entreating the spears of soldiers to be transformed into tears and into mercy and forgiveness. London, a further poem in this collection, deepens the anger and despair that Blake feels. I wander through each chartered street, near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. in every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mine-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. This is an enormously powerful apocalyptic poem. It's very interesting technically. He uses simple vocabulary and repetition to create a sense of incantation, as if a spell were being cast. The chartered streets refers to the system of commercial management or charters that existed in the city. The same system extends into nature too, the chartered Thames. Blake is saying that even the ancient and unencumbered river is managed for profit. Having repeated chartered, his next repetition is grammatically more elaborate, and mark in every face I meet, marks of weakness, marks of woe. The first mark means observe, and the second means signs. And by linking himself grammatically with what he's observing, Blake makes us feel that he's intimately involved in the suffering that he sees. We also feel implicated too. The three repetitions of mark create a sense of inescapability, as if the misery, like the signs or marks of it, are all around us and unavoidable. He uses the same device in the next stanza, in every cry of every man, where he uses every five times. Suffering is ubiquitous. The lines about the chimney sweeper and the soldier are technically fascinating. Blake is using a completely original effect of pictorial compression. In the space of 10 words, he makes the meaning skip from one sense to another so that a noise becomes a colour. He does this twice. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls. The shout of the chimney sweep turns into the church walls, which are blackened by pollution and by the commercial system that forces innocent children to sweep chimneys. Then the breath of the dying soldier turns into the crimson of the palace walls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. The effect is instantaneous, as vivid as a film, and you can virtually see the soldier collapsing against the wall of the palace. Perhaps he's been executed. Perhaps he's defending the monarchy from revolutionaries. The palace stands for tyranny, obviously. In that sense, these are among the most subversive lines in English poetry. A cry of indignation against war and commercial abuse, or against what we might call the military-industrial complex. And in the final verse, Blake goes even further. The harlot's curse has a double meaning. On one level, it is a shriek of anguish which causes the newborn infant's tears. But the curse also refers to venereal disease transferred from a prostitute to a married man and then onto his wife, so that it blights with plagues the marriage hearse. So he's attacking not just the church, but also the fundamental systems of abuse and hypocrisy that keep a corrupt society functioning. By the end of the poem, we have a sense that an era is coming to an end, as if there's a revolution ahead. This is dangerous writing. We know that Blake applauded the revolution of 1789 and wore the bonnet rouge or red cap in support of the revolutionaries. But when news arrived of the executions and the terror, he threw the cap away in disgust. Blake is attacking the present system, but at the same time, he's concerned about what will happen next. Tomorrow I'll be looking more closely at America and its effect on Blake, who saw it as more than just an image of liberty, but as a nation where political freedom could be a reality. Until then, good night.